Blog Talk Radio. 90s. I'm not sure. I got a CD. And they made the CD out there in the Blue Barn and then brought it in there and gave it to me. That was the board and lodging for the boys when they were out there for about 3 days. And I've got other songs I've played by, but I don't have them on. I don't have them up on the playlist. So very interesting people. Very interesting people. You'll hear some local musicians today that I've accumulated over the years in my acquaintances, and I'll give you a little background on Jack Clatton, a couple other guys. One of them went up on a bus, bought a school bus, reconditioned it, and turned it into a bus, a Ken Kesey psychedelic bus, and moved his family, wife and two kids, into it and traveled up to Oregon and the great Northwest, Washington State. And Jack, I don't know where he went. He was a young guy. There were all these guys. I think there were three or four of them. It was hard to keep track of. Came through and set up camp out in the barn, and turned it into their own recording studio. And cut me a CD. Thanked me for letting them stay here for a while, and they moved on, even to different directions. Like herding cats, I'm telling you. It's always something interesting. And the Blue Barn is no longer, I mean, in lieu of a lot of renovations, a lot of work, as you're well aware of, I have no preference for the work. I could do it or not, do better without it. But the roof blown off the roof of the Blue Barn years ago, well, hasn't been replaced. Place needs painted again. Boy, I'm telling you. Any help is appreciated. Get that Blue Barn going. It was a hotbed for a while. For about 5-10 years, it was a hotbed. It really was. Well, you're listening to Radio Free Kansas. I'm your host, Mike Goodell. You're always welcome to write me at P.O. Box 14, Valley Falls, Kansas, zip code 66088. I enjoy getting mail the old way. I like it. Today's show, well, I've got some audio to play for you. I think it's important for you to check out. And, you know, I think we're obviously descended into a darker time since those days out at the Blue Barn. It's much more interesting, I think. Dangerous, but interesting. I mean, it's not too hard to think about this. I heard, of all things, I heard the old man, Professor Chomsky, Noam Chomsky, on his 23rd appearance on C-SPAN today, and they played him not once, but twice. He was live for beginning at noon and then 2 hours, and then they replayed him immediately in depth. That's the program it's called on C-SPAN. Oh, Noam's getting old, but it's a great, it was a good show. And he's got two new books coming out this year, so check it out. I also heard this. Is there such a thing as Trump fatigue? I think there's probably a lot of deplorable workers who are fed up with Trump and they're suffering from Trump fatigue. Here's a little clip about that.
House voters, even minorities, can they get it together to beat the indispensable man?
I mean, at this moment, it certainly doesn't look good. But I would say that Trump is always his own worst enemy, right? He lost in 2020 because he couldn't get out of his own way. He refuses to let go of this notion that he was victimized in 2020, that it was stolen from him. And if he isn't able to suppress the crazy talk about the election, I think that's Democrats' best weapon against him. It's like, you know, Biden won because there was this fatigue. You know, before, I think he captured it best in that debate where he said, "Oh, would you just shut up, man?" And people laughed. All across, you know, it was true. People were just sick of Trump. Like, and it, actually, this is another quote from Steve Bannon, which like shows you that he's like, how aware he is of all Trump's flaws, and yet still, you know, continues to enable him. But he said Trump is like the bad TV show that you can't cut off. And it's true. I mean, I remember it was like in 2018 or something, and you know, he used to stand in front of the helicopter, and the helicopter's whirring, and he's shouting because he liked that. He liked shouting, and he liked that he could pretend not to hear the reporters' questions when they asked him because of the rotors. And I remember somebody, we were watching it, and it said, like, oh, God, would he just stop? Like, leave us alone. And so there is, like, a certain sense that people remember the absurdity and the exhaustion, especially, of those 4 years. So I wouldn't say that all hope is lost for Democrats by any stretch of the imagination, because Trump has shown time and time again how self-destructive he is.
That's right. He has. He may be his own worst enemy right now. I don't know. I don't know how it's going to come out. I don't. Well, I want to know, but I don't. I'm not going to get anxious and suffer anxiety attacks over the fate of the Republican Party. That was on C-SPAN today, what I just played you, from a book review of non-Democrats. They were not Democrats. They were Republicans talking about this. I think there might be something to that. You can call in, area code 646-716-8652. I do have more clips to play. And I'm determined to get through them, so I may not be able to give you the microphone as long as you want, but you're more than welcome to call in. Again, that's area code 646-716-8652. And let's put on a little bit. Let me look here and find some more music for us and take a short break. Well, wait a minute. Here, there's something here. This is interesting. I've played this guy many times on Radio Free Kansas when I have an open mic and I can run the audio board. I was shocked. I am frankly shocked at the developments of what's happened since Russiagate. You know, every Democrat who doesn't go along with the party line is accused of being a puppet of Putin. That's been going on for years now. Years. And I think it's just the Democratic Party's way of inoculating itself from radical change, I think. They don't want to hear about capitalism or billionaires. They don't want to hear about the old man Bernie. They don't want to hear about it. Well, now it's come down since the invasion, conflict, war, if you want to call it that. I wouldn't call it a war, in Ukraine. It's now they've taken to supporting the censoring of important journalists. And here's a couple days ago on Democracy Now!, here's Chris Hedges.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We spend the rest of the hour with Chris Hedges, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, who's just seen YouTube delete the entire archive of his Emmy-nominated television show On Contact, which he hosted for 6 years on RT America, a news channel funded by the Russian government that recently closed down. This comes as Britain announced Thursday new sanctions on 14 more Russian entities and people, including state media organizations behind RT and Sputnik, and some of their senior figures to target those who spread President Putin's what they called, quote, fake news and narratives. RT's deputy editor-in-chief, Anna Belkina, told Reuters, quote, "With this action, the UK government has sounded the death knell for media freedom in Britain." Belkina said Britain had tried to silence both RT and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. For more, we're joined in New York by Chris Hedges, who is just back from London as a guest at the wedding of the imprisoned WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange and his partner, now wife, Stella Morris. We'll talk more about that in a minute. But first, Chris, you wrote a piece headlined On Being Disappeared about having your RT show's archive completely deleted, saying, if this happens to me, it can happen to you, to any critic anywhere who challenges the dominant narrative. Chris Hedges, can you lay out what happened?
There was no notice. There was no warning. There was no inquiry. It just vanished. It's not surprising. I think if you go back and look at the 2017 Director of National Intelligence report, 7 pages were devoted to RT, and while they accused RT of disseminating Russian propaganda, all the examples that they cited in that report were that RT was giving a voice to Black Lives Matter activists, anti-fracking activists, Occupy activists, third-party candidates, all of which was true. And so I think this was the culmination. We expected it. I was on your show, by the way, when they deleted Trump from the social media and vigorously opposed it, not because I ever want to read another tweet by Donald Trump, but because we don't want these opaque entities, and they know everything about us. We know nothing about them, to wield this kind of censorship. What I didn't expect when I was arguing not to delete Trump from social media was that I would so quickly be one of the victims.
So do you have any access to this archive?
Through the RT.com On Contact site is still up. I don't know how much longer, so we've copied them, so at least I'll have them. But no, off of YouTube, and you had hundreds of thousands of views for some of those shows, it's all gone. I want to stress that there wasn't one show on Russia, and the few times that we ever mentioned Putin or Russia was not in very flattering terms. I remember great investigative journalist Alan Naron using RT, I'm sure, on purpose to excoriate Russia for war crimes in Syria, but we broadcast it. This was a show that, if we had a functioning public broadcasting system, would be on probably late at night. I primarily interviewed authors. I'm an author myself, of course. I've written 14 books. Intellectuals that I admire, Cornel West, Noam Chomsky, Slavoj Žižek, it was erased for its content. I mean, not because it was Russian propaganda, but because it wasn't, but because there's been such a marginalization of critics of anti-imperialism, anti-capitalism. I'm a very strong supporter, very public supporter of the boycott, divestment, sanction movement, which, of course, I think was the key issue that saw my great friend Cornel West denied tenure at Harvard. The walls have just closed in, Amy. Since I began as a reporter in Central America in the 1980s, there's less and less space for those who are willing to seriously challenge and question entrenched power. I mean, you do it. Alan does it. But it's become a pretty lonely profession. And, of course, Bob Scheer, who I write for SheerPost, but he doesn't have any money. He doesn't have any advertisers. It was also true when he ran Ramparts. So it's becoming harder and harder. I've gone to Substack like Matt Taibbi and Glenn Greenwald, chrishedges.substack.com. And if I can get enough subscribers, I will fund the column and fund the show myself. But that's where we're left at. And, of course, you pioneered that model for many of us.
And, Chris, If you were on RT America right now, if it existed, if Direct TV hadn't canceled, taken RT America off, what would you be saying about Russia's invasion of Ukraine?
Well, I denounced Russia's invasion of Ukraine at the inception for the same reason I denounced our invasion and occupation of Iraq at the inception, for which, of course, I ran into conflict and had to leave the New York Times, because preemptive war under post-Nuremberg laws is a criminal war of aggression. And I was very clear about that. Now, RT went dark 6 days later. I have a hard time believing Moscow would have allowed me to publicly embrace that kind of critique and remain on the air. I mean, I don't know. That's conjecture. But yes, I can't. It would be deeply hypocritical to lambast the United States for war crimes and not lambast Vladimir Putin for war crimes. With this caveat, the invasion of Iraq, occupation of Iraq, was based on lies and fabrications. I believe I was in Europe in 1989 covering the revolutions in Eastern Europe. This, of course, was we assumed naively that NATO would be obsolete. NATO was created to prevent Soviet expansion in Eastern, in Central Europe. I saw the leaders of Margaret Thatcher and the Reagan administration, Hans-Dietrich Genscher, all promise Gorbachev that NATO would not be expanded beyond the borders of a unified Germany. Then later with the Clinton administration, after 13 or 14 states now, of course, are been integrated into NATO. Clinton administration promised not to station troops. This was another violation. Russia has every right to feel threatened and baited. That doesn't justify the war crime that they committed. I mean, they pulled the trigger. But again, this kind of understanding of the historical antecedents that led to the attack on the Ukraine, you've had Katrina on here. She, of course, knows Russia very well. That's almost unheard of within the kind of cheerleading for the media, within the mainstream media.
Katrina VandenHeuvel, the publisher of The Nation. Chris, you wrote the award-winning book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. What does this war give Russia in terms of meaning?
Well, and I just read the New York Times this morning, and they're talking about Putin's approval ratings going through the roof. That's what war does. It unleashes all sorts of dark, toxic poisons, including the poison of nationalism, which we imbibed in Iraq, and I think to a certain extent are imbibing now, ignoring the two decades of egregious war crimes that we committed in the Middle East. The idea that somehow NATO is a defensive organization would be greeted with ridicule in countries like Iraq or Afghanistan or Syria or anywhere else, or Libya or anywhere else. Of course, every society is susceptible to that dark elixir, and Russia is no exception. They've, of course, turned on their press, and they're drinking deep from it. But we're as guilty of that sin as the Russians.
What would you say to critics that say RT America, RT, was an outlet for Russian state propaganda, which is why it was targeted for removal by YouTube?
Well, to a certain extent, that's probably true. But are we better off not hearing what Russia has to say, not understanding why they think the way they do? I was a foreign correspondent for 20 years. My job was to be culturally, linguistically, historically, religiously literate, to step into the shoes of a Syrian or an Iraqi or a Palestinian. And of course, I spent 6 years in Latin America and then later in Yugoslavia, and explain how the world looked from their vantage point, why they felt the way they did. And oftentimes, the grievances they have are very legitimate. I certainly think that Putin's complaints about the expansion of NATO have a great deal of credibility. It's just a historical fact that the leaders of the West lied to Gorbachev, lied to Yeltsin, and lied to Putin. That's just historically true. We're not a better world by shutting down these outlets and essentially living within our own echo chamber, especially when we wield the kind of military power that we do wield. And this gets into the whole collapse of foreign reporting. Kind of gone the way of the dinosaurs, but it's extremely important, especially when you're an imperial power.
Die Gedanken sind frei, my thoughts freely flower. Die Gedanken sind frei, my thoughts give me power. No scholar can map them, no hunter can trap them, no man can deny. Die Gedanken sind frei, no man can deny. Die Gedanken sind frei. I think as I please, and this gives me pleasure. My conscience decrees, this right I must treasure. My thoughts will not cater to duke or dictator. No man can deny. Die Gedanken sind frei. No man can deny. Die Gedanken sind frei. And should tyrants take me and throw me in prison, my thoughts will burst free like blossoms in season. Foundations will crumble and structures will tumble, and free men will cry, die Gedanken sind frei. And free men will cry, die Gedanken sind frei.
Die Gedanken sind frei. I mean, it's my thoughts are free. Pete Seeger, years ago, sang that repeatedly, unknown to many people. This was the same anthem, a melody. Actually, it's a melody. It's a drinking song from the 1830s of college students in Germany. And it became an anthem that was sang to the attempted revolution throughout Europe of 1848, called the Old 48ers, who attempted to overthrow, and did to a certain extent, overthrow the monarchies of Europe, the Habsburg Empire, and even the British Empire, the royalty, the monarchy. Those notions were thrown off in 1848. They weren't always the democratic revolutions. Generally they were, but I mean there were setbacks, as every convulsion of revolution is. Seeger sang that song, and it was sang by people who in 1941 began organizing against Hitler in Germany. They were singing it in Germany again against Hitler. A group called the White Rose was captured and executed in 1943, early, for organizing resistance groups through the mail to Hitler, and the consequence of the outrageous military movement that occurred in World War II. Here's another one, Sharon Jones, and may she rest in peace.
This land is your land. Ribbon of a highway.
Sharon Jones. I think that's Sharon Jones. Anyhow, Rest in Revolt. The sister has passed. We've got a lot more to go. We've got an extended clip from the Gray Zone coming up. I want you to listen to it. It's with a retired ambassador of the United States, Charles Freeman, Chaz. He's also known as Chaz Freeman. And he is an old guy, but boy, he's talking some real good sense. You know, you never know. Did you listen to yesterday's Abolitionist Hour?
Hi, listeners. This is Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m., we'll talk about prisons since the Fugitive Slave Act to the Attica Uprising to 2018 prison strike. Stay tuned for more information on strikes and rebellions wherever they occur. Only on the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. See you there.
Coming up, the Gray Zone. Extended interview with Charles Freeman, retired ambassador. We'll be right back. Yes, a rare bootleg copy of Jefferson Airplane available at the Internet Archive in the public domain. If you're not familiar with The Gray Zone or Aaron Maté's show Pushback, you really need to get a hold of that channel on YouTube. Max Blumenthal, Aaron Maté, and others really contribute some great material countering the narrative, the popular narrative here in the United States about the necessity of war, expanding NATO, putting up missile defense shields and missiles launch on the border of Russia. To hear the other side of it, this is a I'm not going to tell you the date because it's surprisingly prescient. It really foretold what was about to happen. He's right on top of it. Aaron Maté with Pushback and The Gray Zone on YouTube. I'll be back with you in about 36 minutes.
Welcome to Pushback. I'm Aaron Maté. Joining me is Chaz Freeman. He is a retired veteran U.S. diplomat who served in a number of senior positions, including as the Assistant Secretary of Defense and U.S. Ambassador to Saudi Arabia. Chaz Freeman, thank you for joining me.
Pleasure to be with you.
What is your assessment of the Russian invasion so far and how the Biden administration has responded to it?
A huge question. I thought in the run-up to this that Mr. Putin was following a classic form of coercive diplomacy, massing troops on Ukraine's border, issuing very clear offers to negotiate, threatening indirectly to escalate beyond the border, not in Ukraine, which the Russians repeatedly said they did not intend to invade, but perhaps through putting pressure on the United States, similar to the pressure that the Russians feel from us, namely missiles within no warning distance at all of the capital. Of course, Washington doesn't have quite the significance in our case that Moscow does for the Russians, but still. I thought that was what was in store. I was stunned when Putin actually invaded Ukraine. I don't think his troops were prepared for it. There's no evidence that they had the logistics in place or that the troops were briefed about where they were going and why. And so it looks like an impetuous decision. And if so, it ranks with the decision of Tsar Nicholas II, the last Tsar, to go to war with Japan in 1904. That had disastrous consequences for political order in Russia. I think this is a comparable blunder. There are lots of things being said about the course of the war, which is now about a month old. And many of them are, I think, frankly, tendentious nonsense. For example, it's alleged that the Russians are deliberately targeting civilians. But I think in most wars, the ratio of military to civilian deaths is roughly 1-to-1. And in this case, the reported civilian deaths are about 1/10 of that, which strongly suggests that the Russians have been holding back. We may now see the end of that with the ultimatum that has been issued in connection with Mariupol, if I understood correctly what the Russians were saying, they were saying surrender or face the consequences, and the consequences would be a terrible leveling of the city. We don't know where this war is going to end, whether there will be a Ukraine or how much of a Ukraine there will be, what the effects inside Russia will be. There's clearly a lot of dissent in Russia, although I'm sure it's being exaggerated by our media. The war is a fog of lies on all sides. It is virtually impossible to tell what is actually happening because every side is staging the show. The champion of that is Mr. Zelensky, who is brilliant as a communicator, it turns out. He's an actor who has found his role, and it probably helps Ukraine a great deal to have a president who is an accomplished actor, who came equipped with his own studio staff, who is using that brilliantly. And I would say Mr. Zelensky was elected to head a state called Ukraine, and he has created a nation called Ukraine. He is somebody whose perceived heroism has rallied Ukrainians to a degree that no one ever expected. But we don't know where this is going. And more to the point, the United States is not part of any effort to negotiate an end to the fighting. To the extent that there is mediation going on, it seems to be by Turkey, possibly Israel, maybe China, and that's about it. The United States is not in the room. Everything we are doing, rather than accelerating an end to the fighting and some compromise, seems to be aimed at prolonging the fighting, assisting the Ukrainian resistance, which is a noble cause, I suppose, but it will result in a lot of dead Ukrainians as well as dead Russians. Sanctions have no goals attached to them. There are no conditions which we stated which would result in their end. And finally, we have people now calling, including the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of Great Britain, calling Putin a war criminal and professing that they will intend to bring it to trial somehow. This gives Mr. Putin absolutely no incentive to compromise or reach an accommodation with the Ukrainians, and it probably guarantees a long war. And there seem to be a lot of people in the United States who think that's just dandy. It's good for the military-industrial complex. It's, uh, it It reaffirms our negative views of Russia. It reinvigorates NATO. It puts China on the spot. You know, what's so terrible about a long war? You know, if you're not Ukrainian, you probably, you know, see some merit in a long war. So this has not gone as anybody predicted. Not Mr. Putin, not the intelligence community in the United States, which extrapolated war plans from the disposition of forces on the Ukrainian border, not the way the Germans, who are now rearming, anticipated. It's got a lot of shock value to it, and it's changing the world in ways we still don't understand.
I wonder if U.S. intelligence extrapolated that Russia would invade based on the certainty that the U.S. would reject Russia's core security demands, namely neutrality for Ukraine and Ukraine not joining NATO. And I'm wondering if their assurance that Biden would reject those demands made them, if that's what made them, all the more confident that Russia would then invade. And on that point about NATO, I wanted to get your response to some comments that Zelensky recently made. He was speaking to Fareed Zakaria of CNN, and he made what I thought was a really telling admission about what he was told to say publicly about NATO before the war.
I requested them personally to say directly that we are going to accept you into NATO or NATO in a year or two or five. Just say it directly and clearly, or just say no. And the response was very clear. You are not going to be a NATO or EU member, but publicly the doors will remain open. But if you are not ready to preserve the lives of our people, if you just want to see us straddle two worlds, if you want to see us in this dubious position where we do not understand whether you can accept us or not, you cannot place us in this situation. You cannot forces to be in this limbo.
So that's Zelensky saying that he was told by NATO members, presumably the U.S., that we're not going to let you in, but publicly we're going to leave the door open. I'm wondering, Ambassador Freeman, your response to that.
Well, those are two questions. First, in my experience, the intelligence community does not start from estimates of U.S. policy. And I think what we saw was an order of battle analysis with the judgment as expressed at one point by Secretary of State Blinken that, you know, if we massed 150,000 troops on somebody's border, that would mean we were about to invade. In other words, mirror imaging. You know, that's what we would do. Therefore, that's what the Russians will do. I think Mr. Putin was surprised by being stiff-armed on the, after all, 28-year-old demand that NATO stop enlarging in the direction of Russia. At root, this is a contest over whether Ukraine will be in the U.S. sphere of influence, the Russian sphere of influence, or neither's. And neutrality, which is what Mr. Putin had started out saying he wanted, was compatible with neither side having Ukraine within its sphere. Whether that's now possible or not, I don't know. I think one of the mistakes Mr. Putin made in upping the ante was to make it very difficult for Ukraine to become neutral. But on the question of what Mr. Zelensky was told, I think this is remarkably cynical, or perhaps it was naive and unrealistic on the part of leaders in the West. Zelensky is obviously a very intelligent man, and he saw what the consequences of being put in what he called limbo would be. Namely, Ukraine would be hung out to dry, and the West was basically saying, we will fight to the last Ukrainian for Ukrainian independence, which essentially remains our stand. It's pretty cynical, despite all the patriotic fervor. And I'd add, you know, I have heard, I know people who have been attempted to be objective about this, and they're immediately accused of being Russian agents, or that is to say, the price of speaking on this subject is to join the pom-pom girls in a frenzy of support for our position. If you're not part of the chorus, you're not allowed to say anything, and not you can't sing. So I think that this has had very injurious effects on Western liberties. And it has enforced an almost, I won't say it's totalitarian, but it's certainly a similar kind of control on freedom of expression. And inquiry in the West. It's very depressing, really. We should rise to this occasion. We should be concerned about achieving a balance in Europe that sustains peace. That requires incorporating Russia into a governing council for Europe of some sort. In Europe, historically, has been at peace only when all the great powers who could overthrow the peace have been co-opted into it. A perfect example is the Congress of Vienna, which followed the Napoleonic Wars, where Kissinger's great hero Metternich and others had the good sense to reincorporate France into the governing councils of Europe. And that gave Europe 100 years of peace. Of course, there were a few minor conflicts, but nothing major. And after World War I, when the victors, the United States and Britain and France, insisted on excluding Germany from a role in the affairs of Europe, as well as this newly formed Soviet Union, the result was World War II and the Cold War. So instead of, it's really depressing that instead of trying to figure out how to give Russia reasons not to invade countries and to violate international law as it has. That does not make Russia unique, of course, but instead of trying to give Russia reasons for being well-behaved, we have, in its view, left it with no alternative but the use of force.
Can you take us back to the 1990s? You served in the Clinton administration at a time when there was a big discussion, big debate in Washington over the future of European security architecture. This is after the Soviet Union had collapsed. Russia was never weaker. There were people, including inside the George H.W. Bush administration, who talked about pledging support for neutrality, not trying to bring the former Soviet states into one camp or the other. And Clinton ultimately, Bill Clinton, President Clinton, went with NATO expansion, went with violating the pledges that accompanied the end of the Soviet Union to expand NATO to Russia's borders. Can you take us back to that time and the debates that were taking place and how that's fueled the crisis we're in today?
Well, I actually had a good deal to do with the formulation of what became known as the Partnership for Peace. And this was two things. It was a pathway to responsible application for NATO membership, but it was also a cooperative security system rather than a collective security system for Europe. It left the members to decide whether they defined themselves as European or not. So Tajikistan joined the Partnership for Peace, but it made no effort to civilianize its defense establishment or subject its military to parliamentary oversight, and it didn't learn the 3,000 standardization agreements that are the operating doctrine of NATO that allow a Portuguese soldier to die for Poland or vice versa. That process was the question of what countries would have what relationship with NATO was left to those countries. What happened in 1994, and which was a midterm election year, and 1996, which was a presidential election year, was interesting. In 1994, Mr. Clinton was talking out of both sides of his mouth. He was telling the Russians that we were in no rush to add members to NATO, and that our preferred path was the Partnership for Peace. At the same time, he was hinting to the ethnic diasporas of Russophobic countries in Eastern Europe. And by the way, it's easy to understand their Russophobia, given their history, that no, we were going to get these countries into NATO as fast as possible. And in 1996, he made that pledge explicit. 1994, he got an outburst from Yeltsin, who was then the president of the Russian Federation. 1996, he got another one. And as time went on, when Mr. Putin came in, he regularly protested the enlargement of NATO in ways that disregarded Russia's self-defense interests. So there should have been no surprise about this. For 28 years, Russia has been warning that at some point it would snap, and it has. And it has done it in a very destructive way, both in terms of its own interests and in terms of the broader prospects for peace in Europe. So there really is no excuse for what Mr. Putin has done. To understand it is not to condone it. So I think what happened here was a combination of forces. There were those people in the United States who were triumphalist about the end of the Cold War. There were those who felt that what they perceived as victory, I think it was a default by the Russians, but anyway, the game was over. This allowed the United States to incorporate all the countries right up to Russia's borders and beyond them, beyond those borders in the Baltics, into an American sphere of influence. And essentially, they posited a global sphere of influence for the United States modeled on the Monroe Doctrine. And that's pretty much what we have. Ukraine entered that sphere of influence. It was not neutral after 2014. That was the purpose of the coup, was to prevent neutrality or a pro-Russian government in Kyiv, and to replace it with a pro-American government that would bring Ukraine into our sphere. Since about 2015, this is, of course, Russia reacted by annexing Crimea. Since 2015, we have, let me say about Crimea. Of course, Russia reacted because its major naval base on the Black Sea is in Crimea. And the prospect that Ukraine was going to be incorporated into NATO and an American sphere of influence would have negated the value of that base. So I don't think it had anything to do with the wishes of the people of Crimea, who, however, were quite happy to be part of Russia rather than Ukraine. So since about 2015, the United States has been arming, training Ukrainians against Russia. Major step up in 2017 in that. Ironically, because of Mr. Trump, you know, who was actually impeached for trying to leverage arms sales to Ukraine for political dirt on the Bidens. But at any rate, it isn't as though Ukraine was not treated as an extension of NATO. It was. And this had a good deal to do with the Russian decision to invade, I'm sure. It's not, at the moment, I understand the Ukrainian forces, although they've lost their command and control, there are major units that are surrounded and in danger of being annihilated by the Russians. There are cities that are in danger of being pulverized. None of this has happened yet, but the Ukrainians do not lack weaponry. They have more than enough to deal with the Russian forces on a dispersed basis, and they have shown themselves to be very courageous in defending their country with those weapons. A lot of them are dying for their country. One can admire that, but one must also lament it.
I'm going to quote you, Elliot Cohen served as a counselor to Condoleezza Rice when she was the Secretary of State. And he writes this in the Atlantic magazine. He says, the United States and its NATO allies are engaged in a proxy war with Russia. They are supplying thousands of munitions and hopefully doing much else, sharing intelligence, for example, with the intent of killing Russian soldiers. And because fighting is, as the military theorist Karl von Clausewitz said, a trial of moral and physical forces through the medium of the latter, we must face a fact. To break the will of Russia and free Ukraine from conquest and subjugation, many Russian soldiers have to flee, surrender, or die, and the more and faster, the better. That's Elliot Cohen, former State Department advisor in the Atlantic. I'm wondering your response to that, especially him calling, just openly declaring that the U.S. is using Ukraine for what he calls a proxy war against Russia.
Well, Professor Cohen is a very honest man, which is to his credit, and therefore his adherence to neoconservative objectives is entirely transparent. And what he just said, what you quoted him as saying, is consistent with the neoconservative objective of regime change in Russia. And it's also consistent with fighting to the last Ukrainian to achieve it. I find it deplorable. But I have to say, it's probably representative of a very large body of opinion in Washington.
And why? Why does this view of Ukraine as essentially cannon fodder against Russia, why is it so prevalent in Washington?
This is essentially cost-free for the United States. As long as we don't cross some Russian red line that leads to escalation against us, we are engaged, as Mr. Cohen's, Professor Cohen said, in a proxy war. And we're selling a lot of weapons. That makes arms manufacturers happy. We're supporting a valiant resistance, which gives politicians something to crow about. We're going against an officially designated enemy, Russia, which makes us feel vindicated. So from the point of view of those with these self-interested views of the issue, this is a freebie.
And as someone with extensive experience in China, you served as President Nixon's translator, interpreter, when he did his historic visit to China. I'm wondering what you make of China's response to Russia's invasion so far and these warnings that they've been receiving in recent days from the Biden administration, trying to basically tell them not to help out Russia or else there will be consequences.
Well, this has been fascinating to watch. The Chinese clearly agree with Mr. Putin and Russian nationalists in objecting to NATO enlargement. Having been subjected to foreign spheres of influence in the 19th and 20th century, they don't like them. They don't believe Ukraine should be part of either the Russian or the U.S. sphere of influence. They are the last citadel of Westphalianism in the world. They really do believe strongly in sovereignty and territorial integrity. Mr. Putin went to Beijing for the Winter Olympics and had a long discussion with Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, and they agreed that NATO should not enlarge. There should not be spheres of influence, and that the security architecture in Europe needed to be adjusted to relieve Russia of the sense of menace, but an experience. I don't believe for a minute that Mr. Putin told Mr. Xi that he planned to invade Ukraine. In fact, he may have said he had no intention of doing it. I don't know. He may indeed have had no intention of doing it at that point, assuming that his coercive diplomacy was going to get a response. But of course, it got no response. It got an evasive set of counterproposals about arms control, which didn't address the main question he was raising, which was how Russia could feel secure when a hostile alliance was advancing through its very borders. Anyway, poor Mr. Xi Jinping now has to straddle something he probably almost certainly had no idea was in prospect. On the one hand, he can oppose spheres of influence and demand consideration for the security concerns of great powers, as he does with regard to Russia and with regard to his own country. But on the other hand, Ukraine is being violated. So the Chinese have had an awkward straddle. The irony is, I don't think this was intended, but inadvertently, this has put them in a position where they're one of the few countries that might conceivably mediate an end to the fighting. And I noticed that recently, the Chinese have emphasized heavily the need for there to be negotiations to bring that fighting to an end at the earliest possible moment. It doesn't mean that they're going to end up mediating. Mediation is a very difficult thing, and often mediators enter the mediation with two friends and end up with two enemies. So this is not something you take on lightly. At this point, however, I would just say nobody knows what's going on between, or at least nobody who, if anybody does know, they're not saying what's going on between Russians and Ukrainians in the meetings that they are having. The Turks claim that the two sides are close to an agreement. Various points, Lavrov and Kabila, the Ukrainian foreign minister, have both said something similar, but there is no agreement. And it's not clear at this point whether there can be an agreement. By taking the land corridor from Donetsk to Crimea, Mr. Putin has taken something that he probably will be very unwilling to give up. And as I said, you ask Ukrainians to accept neutrality when they've been batted around the way they have been and lost all the lives and property that they have. It's not at all easy for them. So even though from the very beginning the solution has been obvious, which is some variant of the Austrian State Treaty of 1955, meaning a guaranteed independence in return for two things. One, decent treatment of minorities inside the guaranteed state, and second, neutrality for the guaranteed state. This has been there this is still the objective as far as we can tell, but it's been made more difficult rather than less by the outbreak of war.
What's your sense of the agency and the free rein that Zelensky actually has to make decisions and the extent of U.S. influence over him? One of the things that Professor Stephen F. Cohen warned about, the late Professor Stephen F. Cohen warned about, to me in 2019, was that unless the U.S. steps up and supports Zelensky in his mandate of making peace with the rebels in the East, then he has no chance, because otherwise he'll have to submit to the far right inside Ukraine, who are very influential. And since then, I've seen no indication there has been any sort of support from Washington for making peace with Russia. Trump, of course, was impeached when he paused those weapon sales. There's that famous incident where Lindsey Graham and John McCain and Amy Klobuchar go to the front lines in late 2016 of the Ukrainian military's fight against the rebels in the Donbass. And Lindsey Graham says this is 2017 is going to be the year of offense, and Russia has to pay a heavier price.
Your fight is our fight.
2017
will be the year of offense. All of us will go back to Washington, and we will push the case against Russia.
Ми всі повернемося до Вашингтону, і ми будемо відстоювати санкції проти Росії.
Enough of a Russian aggression.
Досить вже російської агресії.
It is time for them to pay a heavier price.
Час вже, щоб вони заплатили важчу ціну.
I believe you will win. I am convinced you will win, and we will do everything we can to provide you with what you need to win.
Even fast forward to when Biden came in, Time magazine reported that when Zelensky shut down the three leading opposition TV networks in Ukraine, that that was conceived as a welcome gift to the Biden administration to fit with the Biden administration's agenda. So what's your sense of all that, the agency that Zelensky actually has and the extent of U.S. influence over his decisions?
Zelensky was elected by a landslide, not because of anything except he wasn't all the other candidates. His political capital very quickly evaporated, and he really had no power to make decisions. Whether there were other people behind him making decisions or that he mouthed, or whether he was taking instructions from the Biden administration or the Trump administration or whoever, is unclear. But what is clear to me is that Mr. Zelensky's heroic performance as the leader of wartime Ukraine has gained him enormous political capital. He has the ability now to make a compromise. It will not be easy. As you indicated, there are elements in the coalition that support him who are very right-wing and anti-Russian, perhaps even neo-Nazi. And by the way, anti-Semitism is a disastrous aspect of Nazism, but it's not the definition of Nazism. Apparently, you can be a Nazi and have a Jewish president and not feel uncomfortable about it. I think this simplistic argument that, well, because Ukraine has a secular Jewish president who apparently doesn't really identify as Jewish, but is identified as Jewish, this means somehow that there can't be any Nazis backing him. It's ridiculous. There clearly Ukraine has been very divided in multiple directions ever since its independence. And I'm sure those fissures continue to exist. Mr. Zelensky, however, he really has empowered himself, I think, if he gets backing from the United States and others. And here we have a problem. Not only do we have the Putin is a war criminal and must be brought to trial statements coming out of leaders in the West, including President Biden, but we also have people like Boris Johnson saying the sanctions have to stay on whatever Russia does, because Russia has to be punished. Well, this means Russia has absolutely no incentive to accommodate, and it also means that Mr. Zelensky has no freedom to accommodate. So this is the opposite of an effort to resolve the issue. It's an effort, in effect, whatever its intent, to perpetuate the fighting, and that is going to be disastrous for the Ukrainians, for the Russians, and for Europe, and ultimately for the United States.
You mentioned the neo-Nazi issue in Ukraine. Let me quote you from a new article in the Washington Post by Rita Katz. She's the executive director of the Site Intelligence Group. Her article is called "Neo-Nazis Are Exploiting Russia's War in Ukraine for Their Own Purposes." Not since ISIS have we seen such a flurry of recruitment activity. And she writes this: in many ways, the Ukraine situation reminded me of Syria in the early and middle years of the last decade. just as the Syrian conflict served as the perfect breeding ground for groups like Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, similar conditions may be brewing in Ukraine for the far right. I'm wondering your response to that.
Well, I think she's got logic on her side. I frankly don't know Ukraine personally well enough to know exactly what the definition of a member of the Azov Brigade or other neo-Nazi groups is. I think right-wing populism is ugly enough in our own country to imagine that it's even uglier in a country as divided as Ukraine. I don't dismiss the whole thing at all because Ukraine has a horrible history of running pogroms first against Jews and then, frankly, against Russians. To dismiss the argument that there are people with violent tendencies and great prejudice, ethnic prejudices, involved in this fight seems to me to be wrong. So I haven't read the article you cited. I don't know the author, but she makes sense to me.
And I'm curious what you make now of the allegations we're getting from both the U.S. and Russia against the other, that the other side is plotting false flag chemical attacks.
Hmm.
This has only surfaced in recent days. In the case of the U.S., it strikes me that they're recycling a playbook that they employed under the Obama administration, which was there were people inside the Obama White House who wanted to put out the option of military intervention, and the red line was a good way to pursue that. I'm wondering if you think the Biden administration, especially the remnants of the Obama administration, Blinken, Sullivan, are, and Biden himself, are recycling that playbook.
I certainly hope not, but it does have a resemblance to the probably false flag use of chemical weapons in Syria. It almost worked in Syria. It was only at the last minute when the chief of the Joint Chiefs said to the president, you know, this isn't a slam dunk. There are real questions here. And the questions were about whether this was the Turkish or Turkish and Saudi or whoever false flag intended to force an American escalation over Syria. It was only when that happened that Mr. Obama decided that he should remember the Constitution, which he once taught about, which says that only the Congress can authorize a war. The president does not have the constitutional authority to do that. Of course, in practice, presidents since Truman have done so. He put it to the Congress, and the Congress behaved in its usual craven fashion and ducked the issue. And instead, it's unfair to ask us to do our constitutional duty. So we won't. Once again. That almost worked in Syria. And this could well be a replay. From a military point of view, I can't see any reason that the Russians would want to use chemical weapons. Usually they are a defensive device against a mass attack, but there's no such thing going on in Ukraine. They don't need chemical weapons. They have enough frightful weapons of other types without having to do that. So this does strike me as, on its surface, it's suspicious.
You were the former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia. What do you make of their positioning so far? There's a lot of talk of them essentially moving closer with Russia. A lot was made that MBS refused to take Joe Biden's call when he phoned him recently, and Saudi Arabia considering accepting payments for oil in the Chinese currency and the implications of that. Your thoughts there when it comes to Saudi Arabia's apparent shifting stance here?
Saudi Arabia has been very ill at ease with its U.S. relationship for a long time. The affection that the Saudis once enjoyed in the United States, from a limited number of people to be sure, has been replaced by mass Islamophobia. Saudi Arabia has been successfully vilified in U.S. politics. Saudi Arabia's assumption that the United States would back the monarchy against attacks on it from at home or abroad was thrown into doubt when the United States rather gleefully saw Mubarak overthrown in Egypt. The United States is now a competitor for oil production and exports, no longer a consumer. The murder of Jamal Khashoggi and its attribution to Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, obviously does not endear him to us or us to him. And so Mr. Biden has refused to speak with him. So at this point, the Saudis have gone full bore looking for alternative partners to rely upon. And there is no single partner that they can rely upon, but they have every interest in exploring alternative relationships, not just with Russia or China, but with India and others, and they are doing so. The same thing with the United Arab Emirates. It bound to the United States in the so-called Abraham Accords. It has a reputation well-deserved for realpolitik. It too is crafting its own future, and it is not prepared to mortgage that future to American policy, especially when the common view in the Gulf is that the United States is retreating. This brings us all back to the Chinese, the Indians, the Brazilians, others who have not got onto the bandwagon hurling invective at Russia. I think the Chinese ambassador the other day was on one of the Sunday talk shows, and to the extent they let him get a word in, he said very clearly, and I agree with him, that condemnation does not accomplish anything very much at all. And what is required is serious diplomacy. And what has been missing has been serious diplomacy. There have been condemnations, there have been sanctions, there have been arms shipments to the Ukrainians from a remarkable range of sources, by the way. I mean, it illustrates the extent of Mr. Putin's mistake that even Austria and Switzerland, two neutral countries, have provided aid to the Ukrainian resistance, as has Finland. Mr. Putin has paid a huge price in terms of arousing animus against his country.
India and Brazil are in the same situation as China?
They're in the same straddle. They see no benefit in alienating a partner, namely Russia. While they both may care about the independence of Ukraine, I think taking sides with the United States against Russia, which is what they're being asked to do, is a step too far. Let's face it, this is in large measure, as I said at the outset, a struggle between the United States and Russia for a sphere of influence that will include Ukraine. It's US-Russia. It's not Russia versus Europe. In this context, why would a great power that values its cooperation with Russia want to alienate Russia?
We're going to wrap. So any final words for us at the beginning of this interview, you said that the, you know, long-term geopolitical implications of this crisis are unknown. The world is changing in ways we don't know. But I'm wondering if there's any speculation that you are comfortable engaging in about what the geopolitical implications are. A lot of people are speculating that this could mean the weakening of U.S. dollar supremacy as a result of China and Russia drawing closer together. Any thoughts on that? And anything else you want to leave us with as we wrap?
No, I think the reliance on our sovereignty over the dollar to our abuse of that sovereignty, if you will, to impose sanctions that are illegal under the UN Charter, which are unilateral, ultimately risks the status of the dollar. And we may, in fact, be at a moment when the dollar is taken down a notch or two. You know, it isn't the case. Well, I should just say that the dollar serves two purposes. One is as a store of value. If you have dollars, you're fairly confident that they're going to have a significant value 10 years from now, as well as today. So that is why countries keep reserves in dollars. And it's why people stash dollars in mattresses all over the world. The other use of the dollar is to settle trade transactions. It's the most convenient currency in which to do that. And in many cases, when other currencies are used, they are used with reference to the dollar and the dollar exchange rates. Both of these things are now in jeopardy. The oil trade, commodities, being priced in dollars is the basis for the dollar's international value. If you look at the United States trade and balance of payments, you will see that we are in chronic deficit. That says the dollar is overvalued. And that means it's vulnerable to devaluation. So if you start saying, SWIFT, the communications system in Belgium that handles most of the world's transactions was established to ensure that trade could be conducted unencumbered by politics. And now it's being encumbered by U.S.-imposed unilateral sanctions on a huge array of countries, Iran, Russia, China, you name it, even threatened against India. But so if the use of the dollar is now encumbered, it's less desirable and people will want to make workarounds around it. Will the dollar hold its value? We have a Congress that repeatedly goes to the brink of defaulting on our national debt. This is not something that inspires confidence. And I'll add a final factor, which I think is very injurious potentially, and that is bankers get deposits because they are fiduciaries. They are meant to hold the deposits for the benefit of those who deposit the money and not to rip it off themselves. But we've just confiscated the entire national treasury of Afghanistan, and we've confiscated half of Russian reserves. We've confiscated the Venezuelan reserves. We have our ally, the British, have confiscated Venezuela's gold reserves. The Anglo-American reputation as bankers, as fiduciaries, is in trouble. And so the question is, if you're a country that thinks, well, maybe you might have some serious policy difference with the United States someday, why would you put your money in dollars? The answer has been there's no alternative. But there are now major efforts being made to create alternatives. So we're not there yet, but this is a you know, and I don't want to make a prediction, but I think this is a major question that we need to monitor carefully. Because if the dollar loses its value, the American influence on the global level decreases enormously.
Chaz Freeman, thank you as always for your time and insight. I say this on behalf of many people in my audience who have come to rely on your expertise. It's really, really appreciated. So thank you.
It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Hard to believe that that was broadcast on March 22nd. At least it was published on YouTube, courtesy of Aaron Maté and The Gray Zone on their YouTube channel. I think it really speaks a lot about where we're at right now. It's not that old, not that dated, not at all.
I've traveled around this country from shore to shining shore. It really made me wonder the things I heard and saw. I saw the weary farmer a plowing sod and loam. I heard the auction hammer just a knocking down his home. But the banks are made of marble with a guard at every door, and the vaults are stuffed with silver that the farmer sweated for. I've seen the seamen standing idly by the shore, and I heard their bosses saying, got no work for you no more. But the banks are made of marble with a guard at every door, and the vaults are stuffed with silver that the seamen sweated for. I've seen the weary miner scrubbing coal dust from his back, and I've heard his children crying, got no coal to heat the shack. But the banks are made of marble with a guard at every door, and the vaults are stuffed with silver that the miner sweated for. I've seen my brothers working throughout this mighty land. I prayed we'd get together and together make a stand. Then we might own those banks of marble with a guard at every door, and we would share those vaults of silver that we have sweated for.
This is Fred Whitehead beginning a series of talks for Radio Free Kansas on the subject of Kansas history, under the general heading, Our Hidden Heritage. One of the important books of 20th century American history was written by William Appleman Williams, who was a professor of history for many years at the University of Wisconsin and later in Oregon. One of his influential books is called The Contours of American History. In this series, which will follow no particular chronological order, though in the course of the series, we hope to cover many significant topics in our history, we'd like to look at what shaped Kansas and shaped Kansas history in terms of the thought patterns, patterns of social organization, ideology, and culture that prevailed here. In his book, Williams talks about his point of departure being Weltanschauung, or worldview, Weltanschauung being, of course, a German term. More usable English term is simply worldview. In his book, Williams is concerned to trace the deep patterns of American history going back to the 18th century and talks about things like mercantilism, even uses the word capitalism, and in some of his other books, Williams was much concerned to explore the idea that empire of some form had been extremely significant in American history. Similarly, this series will look at property rights. For example, the critical feature of 19th century Kansas history, or one of the critical features, was the dispossession of the Native Americans in Kansas Territory, then in the state of Kansas. Many of these tribes, some tribes like the Kansa, for whom the state is named, were native to this area, while others, such as the Delawares and the Wyandots and the Shawnees, were the so-called immigrant tribes who had been forced to come out here from places like Ohio for what they thought and were guaranteed by the United States government to be their permanent home. Another thing we'll be looking at is the formative free state period of the 1850s, where the Kansas-Nebraska Act provided that the question of slavery and, in fact, the definition of territorial and pending state government would be shaped by those who lived in the territory. And, of course, slavery being a critical issue, the extension of slavery was favored by people from Missouri, which was a slave state. And this prompted a ferocious armed combat that began in 1855-1856 with fighting, with armed struggle and conflict. The late novelist Truman Nelson came to Kansas, returned to Kansas in 1979, where I interviewed him for a film we subsequently made called John Brown in Kansas, and I remember Truman saying, "Kansas was big, it was bigger than Watergate." The momentum of the Free State Movement, which attracted some of the most brilliant and dedicated abolitionists and other free spirits, produced a momentum which extended for several decades after the admission of Kansas as a state on January 29, 1861. This momentum produced what has been called the Laboratory of Social Experimentation, which we will explore in subsequent talks. One of the movements that was highly dramatic was the populist movement of the 1890s. And it is indicative of our present condition that I would wager to say most students, and indeed most people in the state of Kansas, have no idea what populism was and could not define the term. So one of the things we'll be dealing with is the issue of amnesia. And this is not a sort of passive process. I could almost coin a new phrase or a new word, amnesification. How is it that people could forget? The historian Lawrence Goodwin, in his book Democratic Promise, later abridged as the Populist Moment, states that the populist movement was the largest democratic mass movement in American history. So how is it that this could go into oblivion in public consciousness among our people? To put it more positively, as the novelist William Faulkner said, the past is not dead, it is not even the past. So recovering what happened in Kansas history is, as Mairdell LeSueur, another novelist and writer who grew up in Kansas, said, memory is a revolutionary act. So in this series, we will be endeavoring to take up a good many topics, many of which will probably be surprising to our listeners. What we intend is the restoration of what social scientists call agency. That is to say, how is it that we can develop a toolbox that will lead to definitive alteration in our circumstances and produce the means of transformational change?
Down last October in a pouring driving rain, the skipper he'd been drinking and the mate he felt no pain. Too close to Three Mile Rock and she was dealt her mortal blow, and the Mary Ellen Carter settled low. There was just us five aboard her when she finally was awash. We'd worked like hell to save her, all heedless of the cost. And the groan she gave as she went down, it caused us to proclaim that the Mary Ellen Carter would rise again. Well, the owners wrote her off, not a nickel would this spend. She gave 20 years of service, boys that met her sorry end. But insurance paid the loss to us, so let her rest below. Then they laughed at us and said we had to go. But we talked of her all winter, some days around the clock. She's worth a $250,000 afloat and at the dock. And with every jar that hit the bar, we swore we would remain and make the Mary Ellen Carter rise again. Rise again, rise again. That her name not be lost to the knowledge of men. All those who loved her best and were with her till the end will make the Mary Ellen Carter rise again. All spring now we've been with her on a barge lent by a friend. 3 dives a day in a hard hat suit, and twice I've had the bends. Thank God it's only 60 feet and the currents here are slow, or I'd never have the strength to go below. But we patched her rent, stopped her vent, dog hatch and porthole down. Put cables to her fore and aft and girded her around. Tomorrow noon we hit the air and then take up the strain and make the Mary Ellen Carter rise again. Rise again, rise again. Let her name not be lost to the knowledge of men. Oh, those who loved her best and were with her till the end will make the Mary Ellen Carter rise again. Leave her there, you see, to crumble into scale. She'd saved our lives so many times, living through the gale. And the laughing drunken rats who left her to a sorry grave, they won't be laughing in another day. And you, to whom adversity has dealt the final blow, with smiling bastards flying to you everywhere you go, turn to and put out all your strength of arm and heart and brain, and like the Mary Ellen Carter, rise again, rise again, rise again. Though your heart is be broken and life about to end, no matter what you've lost, be it a home, a love, a friend, like the Mary Ellen Carter, rise again, rise again, rise.
Thank you for listening tonight. I hope you enjoyed my show.